listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After more than a decade of peaceful reconstruction, the Central American country of Nicaragua has seen unrest that began developing in earnest in April. Western media is only now beginning to report on it, and its causes are being largely misrepresented, as one might expect. To get the story from someone who's been looking at it up close and living in Nicaragua for a few decades, we spoke with a reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua, via Skype Sunday. So we're going to focus on the area where you live, where you've been living for a long time, and maybe we could start with what's happening there right now in Nicaragua, and then some context of what's happened over the last couple of months.
And if we have time, I'd like also to talk about the way the media is being abused and exploited by the Nicaraguan opposition here.
Absolutely. That's part of the story, for sure.
And the news here is completely distorted, and probably the events that I'm going to describe now will be completely new to people because they're just not getting reported. So on and let's go back on last week, Wednesday, May 30th, it was Mother's Day, and there was a big activity in Managua for peace organized by the government. But on the way down to Managua, a group of people that were going to take part in that peace activity were attacked at a roadblock just south of where I live. One person was killed and 27 were injured by opposition gunmen.
Gunmen?
Oh, yeah.
They got shot.
They were using firearms.
Wow.
A friend of ours who's a police officer was shot in the leg, and they fractured his leg. They broke his leg with the gunshot. So and a very serious incident, but that's just characteristic of everything that's been going on ever since April the 18th. And that simply doesn't get reported in the mainstream corporate media in North America and Western Europe.
Right.
So after that same day, at the peace demonstration, just as it was ending around 4:30, 5 in the afternoon, opposition gunmen also attacked families that were taking part in that demonstration. And I think there were 2 dead, many injured. They, at the third attempt, they burnt down a Sandinista radio station called Radio Nueva Radio Ya, which is a very, very popular radio station, and far from political. It's, most of its output is kind of music and popular entertainment stuff for that people here in Nicaragua really enjoy. But because it's run by the government, the opposition gunmen and paramilitaries attacked it and burnt it down. And in the process, they also wounded 10 police officers and attacked the fire service units that turned up to try and put out the fire. So that was what happened in Managua. Then that same night, the opposition paramilitaries again attacked the municipal office here in Escalí. And in that attack, 2 people were killed, and various people injured. One of the people killed was just a bystander, a guy from out of town who worked in a metal workshop here, just down the road from us. So, and at the same time, the opposition paramilitaries also attacked municipal office in Chinandega. Subsequently, they attacked the municipal office in a town south of Managua called Diriá. They attacked a government complex containing offices of various government ministries in León and burnt down 3 of the modules in that complex. And across the country, of course, they're maintaining their roadblocks, so people can't get around. They can't do the normal things that people do in terms of anything. Economic life, commercial life, sorting out medical care, education stuff, and the whole national life is affected by these roadblocks. The opposition media project as being peaceful, but in fact they're operated by delinquents, many of whom are masked and carrying firearms and other weapons.
I mean, are some of the same tactics that were used, that are used when the unrest is excited in Venezuela, for example.
Well, it's a carbon copy.
Yeah.
Friends from Venezuela write to me when I tell them, they write and ask me, well, what's going on? I write and tell them what's going on. They write back to me and they say, well, this is a carbon copy of what happened in Venezuela all through 2017.
Right.
So, and that's the story. Now, if you say, well, why is this happening? Where did this all start? It goes back to a conversation that we had maybe 2 or 3 conversations ago, when the violence actually started back on April 18th, April 19th. But just as in the Ukraine in 2014 and in Syria and Libya in 2011, the pretext for the violence was completely spurious, because the violence and the protests had next to nothing to do with the claimed pretext, which was a government proposal for social security reform that was made in the days prior to, the weekend prior to Wednesday, April the 18th. And it was subsequently withdrawn on April the 22nd. So the pretext for the protests was completely cut away from underneath the protesters, but they continued their violent protests, and it became very clear that what we're dealing with is regime change.
Right.
This is nothing to do with social security reform.
That social security reform aspect, by the way, it's interesting, the narrative that they're trying to spin, that they're starting to weave in the media here, people that are ostensibly on the left, claim essentially that what happened is that the government, by the way, is not really a leftist government. It's entirely in bed with the IMF and with all of the austerity and all of the things that go with that. And as part and parcel of an austerity package directed at the workers, they wanted to do pension reform, and that has provoked a leftist reaction from the students in defense of workers. That's the way that they're portraying it.
Well, and that's completely ridiculous, because the Social Security reform was actually in a measure that protected workers' rights. And what happened was that after something like 18 months, almost 2 years of negotiations, at a tripartite process involving workers, employers, and the government, the employers withdrew. Why did they withdraw? Because the government proposal affected them more than it affected the workers. And that's the reality, and that's why the private business sector originally supported the protests, but now they're very sorry that they did, because the economy has gone down the toilet.
Yeah.
and they're the ones, the medium to large sized businesses based in Nicaragua, the ones that are most affected. And you can see that in the way that the major, the most wealthy interest, corporate interests in the country, continue to support the protests, because their income doesn't depend on productive activity here in Nicaragua. They've got all their money stashed away in hedge funds and in foreign investments that protect their money.
Right.
They don't depend on the productive economy of Nicaragua.
Right.
And the leftists in North America and Western Europe, when are they going to wake up? This is the same model that we've seen everywhere. I mean, pick a country that's been attacked by the United States. It always starts with a supposed violation of basic civil and political rights. And then it rapidly turns into regime change, an attack on the government. And we've seen it time after time after time, and still the people on the left, who call themselves left, they even call themselves anti-imperialist, they still get it hopelessly wrong. Why do they do that? Well, I don't really know the answer to that, but my guess is, I suspect it's because they're so safely ensconced and comfortably ensconced in the corporate consumer capitalist culture that they claim to criticize, that they're incapable of actually seeing things for what they are.
Mm-hmm.
In places like Nicaragua or Libya or Syria or anywhere else, you know?
And one way of putting that is that they are, trying to parse things on behalf of the working class from a petty bourgeois ivory tower.
Well, yeah, sure, and that's, yeah.
Yep.
And who are they to tell ordinary people in Nicaragua what their reality is?
That's right.
Anyway, and the situation here is that ever since the 18th, on the 18th, those protests were legitimate. In my opinion, they were misguided, but they were peaceful and legitimate. And what happened was that government supporters, young government supporters, clashed with the students protesting against the Social Security reform. And as a result of the public order problems that those clashes provoked, in Managua in particular, the police intervened. And by all accounts, they intervened in a heavy-handed way. But there was no student massacre. That's a lie. One of the big lies about the events of the 18th is that there was a student massacre in which 40 students were killed, which is a downright lie. The first casualties of the violence were a Sandinista police officer, a Sandinista government supporter, and a standby, a supermarket worker who had nothing to do with anything. And that was the reality. And then, but the reality quickly changed, because extremist armed groups from the extreme right-wing opposition, groups that are allied with people like Ileana Rose Lehtinen and Marco Rubio in the United States, groups that have actively sought out the support of the anti-Cuban mafia in Florida and the most right-wing elements of the U.S. government. And those elements organized in a very efficient way, a very carefully planned way, the deployment of extremist armed groups that then attacked the police, and then mingling with the students, it was them that provoked the student deaths in a situation in a in circumstances that are completely unclear. I mean, it just happens that we are a friend of the father. We are quite friendly, my partner and I, Louisa, with the father of one of the students that was shot dead in Esteli. Now, he admits that he doesn't know who killed his son, because there's testimony from young people that were involved in the protest that subsequently repented of their participation. It was a hired thugs from El Salvador that killed at least one of those students, and perhaps the second one too. But all that has to be established. And what the government has done is it's played by the book. It's called for dialogue. It suspended the measures that were the pretext for the protests. It asked the Catholic Church to intervene and mediate in a dialogue with the opposition, the very same opposition that was calling for the overthrow of the government and for the government to resign. The government said, all right, well, let's talk. And they asked the right-wing bishops, the ecclesiastical conference here of the Catholic Church, to mediate, so that the opposition had no pretext to say, well, what's the point of the dialogue if there isn't a neutral mediator? And so the dialogue happened. The government invited the Organization of American States to send in a body to investigate the alleged human rights abuses, and that turned up the Commission for the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights sent a delegation that was here for 4 days, did a preliminary investigation, and came to conclusions very similar to the government's own Truth Commission. Both of them are saying, but the Inter-American Commission made its preliminary report about 10 days or so before the government commission made its report. And they said, well, there are 75 dead and around 800 wounded. That's what, 860 or something wounded. And then 10 days later, the government's Truth Commission said, well, what our findings are that there are now 85 dead and just under 1,000 wounded. So what's been happening is that it's the opposition that's been carrying out all the violence. And then they provoke situations in which ordinary Sandinistas and ordinary people that have no political allegiance whatsoever have to defend themselves, but then their media project that as Sandinista paramilitaries attacking the peaceful opposition.
Right.
No, and it's just, it's astonishing how the media here, here inside Nicaragua, they're completely shameless in the way that they broadcast their lies. And for a long time, I didn't understand why are they telling such downright lies? Who do they expect to believe this? And of course, it's not for domestic consumption.
Right.
It's for foreign consumption.
That's right.
And so
American and European leftists, quote unquote, and anyone else who might try to hamper the United States from, you know, getting directly involved if they decide that's what they have to do.
Yeah, and just look at what's been happening. There have been attacks on municipal offices across the country. What's that got to do with social security reform? What's that got to do with peaceful protests? They burnt down municipal offices.
Well, this is what we were looking at. You mentioned Ukraine, Syria, Libya. I mean, these are the same things that happened, and they even accused in Libya, and some Libyan media, but mostly the world media, accused Libya of killing protesters from the air with airplanes, strafing protesters and such. Even when the Russians said, here's all the aerial photography of that location at that time, there's no airplanes.
Right. And so it might be helpful to look at some of the techniques that the opposition used. For example, they'll say, protesters have been refused medical treatment in the public health system, which is a complete lie.
Mm-hmm.
But why do they say that? They say that because they've already set up their own parallel health system, medical care, for opposition protesters that may get wounded or hurt in the activities.
Mm.
And so their wounds and what happened to them can never be verified.
Right.
So then they'll produce an AK-47 bullet, allegedly, from and of course the order here since at least the weekend of the 21st and the 22nd was for the police not to use firearms, not to fire lethal rounds. And so, that just gives you an idea. So that that's one example. Another example is, for example, the media will say, "Oh, we're being attacked." There's a radio news station called 100% Noticias, which is rabidly anti-government here. And on the night of Wednesday the 30th, they claimed that they were being attacked, when in fact it was them that was encouraging the attack on the Sandinista radio station, Nueva Radio Ya. Yeah. So they claimed at about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, they were being attacked. And a couple of people, government supporters, went over to take photos of what was happening, and there was nothing happening. There was no attack. It was a complete lie.
Jeez.
And so then other things that happen are that they'll use footage of their opposition paramilitaries attacking somewhere and setting it on fire. And then they'll say, "Look, these are the Sandinista youth. Look at what they're doing, destroying the country."
This is what they did in Caracas when they had the coup in 2002. There were pictures that supposedly showed Sandinista supporters shooting at protesters, except someone came up with a larger contextual picture that included the cropped picture that had been shown,
right.
And it showed, in fact, what was happening was they were being shot by the right wing death squad people.
And it seems very much to be the case that hired killers, either from Nicaragua itself or from Salvador and Honduras, have indeed been killing their own side in order to, because what they need are martyrs.
Right, that's what they did at Maidan as well, right? And in Damascus too, as a matter of fact.
Right. So, and that goes on, and they pull all kinds of tricks to fool people by use of the media. For example, there's an opposition TV channel here called Canal 10. Now, on the issue of the roadblocks, just imagine this, Don. Imagine if around New York, just say at the time of the Occupy Wall Street protests, imagine if the Occupy Wall Street protesters had set up roadblocks around New York so that nobody could get in or out, and they were armed, and they were masked. And what do you think the government response would be? You know, and obviously they'd have called out the National Guard and shot dead the people trying to impose those roadblocks.
Well, all the Black Panthers did was advocate armed self-defense, and we saw what happened to them, and that was 40, 50 years ago.
Right. So, but here what's happened is that because Nicaragua's history is, it's only after over the last 10, 15, 20 years that a process of reconciliation has been able to overcome all the deep-rooted bitterness,
right,
that was left over from the war of the 1980s,
right,
and the insurrection against Somoza of the late 1970s. So the government here, and people generally, are extremely sensitive to any threat of that kind of armed conflict. Anything that smacks of civil war is just abhorred here. Nobody right. wants to go back to that. And that explains why the government is bending over backwards not to send out the police, send out the army, and go in 2 or 3 days they'd clear all the roadblocks. You know, and they could easily put an end to the violence, but all that would happen is that the armed paramilitaries would migrate to an internal urban front, and they'd set up a rural armed front that would just continue to degenerate civil conflict. And that right. is exactly what the government is trying to avoid.
Well, you know, you have this condition of polarity that gets, you know, at both it's a historical legacy, and it's something that gets excited intentionally from Washington, you know, throughout. Just look at the United States even as a model of that now. And so what happens, though, the government in Nicaragua was masterful since Sandinistas won, you know, election after Chamorro, and has done tremendous reconstruction and construction of the economy. Huge benefits to the people there, but they've done it successfully, including engaging the national bourgeoisie, and in the process. And this is something also that gets from so-called leftists in the United States, who could only dream of having that much power to even sit at a table with those people.
Right.
Is a source of deep criticism of class collaboration and betrayal and all of this nonsense, as if they don't know how to spell NEP, for example.
Yeah, no, and it's deep ignorance and deep kind of suburbia is the word, deep arrogance.
Yeah,
because the Nicaragua's economy. And look at the global context in which the Sandinista Front came to power in January 2007.
Right.
What are they going to do? They're going to nationalize everything?
Right.
Give me a break.
Right.
So then what did they do? They set about democratizing the economy, and they've been incredibly successful in that. The associative cooperatives for small family business, micro business, that economy generates 70% of the employment here in Nicaragua. The business sector here in Nicaragua is not the main motor of Nicaragua's GDP.
Right.
The main motor of Nicaragua's GDP is, in order, the popular associative cooperative family-based economy, which contributes over 50% of GDP, around 52-53%.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you've got government investment. And then after that, you've got foreign direct investment. Cool. And then well behind that, you've got the contribution of the country's private business sector.
Right.
So it's absolutely stupid and ignorant to say, Daniel is in bed with the local bourgeoisie.
Right.
And it's just so stupid. And in terms of basic social, economic, and cultural rights. And this government has, and over the last 10 years, it's distributed over 100,000 property titles to people across the country. And in Nicaragua, indigenous people have 33, they have property rights to 33% of Nicaragua's national territory.
Wow. Wow.
Right? And remember that Nicaragua is the biggest country in Central America. People often forget that, although it has a small population of only 6.5 million.
Right.
That's because so much of its territory is a virgin forest or land that hasn't been exploited by the corporate capitalist system that dominates countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. But and that's a whole other discussion. And there's the whole environmental discussion, of course. But the nitty-gritty in terms of the economy is that this government has been, certainly in Central American terms, it is the most progressive, socially progressive government in the region.
Right.
Only Venezuela, Bolivia, and Cuba have social indicators for those kinds of things, like participation of ordinary people in the economy, access to basic health and education rights, access to property rights, land reform, all that kind of stuff. All those progressive issues that liberals and progressives and radicals of any stripe in North America and Western Europe should be celebrating, Nicaragua is a regional leader.
And they didn't start from that position. This has been accomplished since 2007.
Absolutely. They were lucky because they had the benefit of the enduring legacy of the revolution of the 1980s.
Right.
But they took office after 17 years of structural adjustment, Washington Consensus, IMF and World Bank imposed policies.
And civil war or whatever, the U.S. war.
Yeah. So then, and as you look at that, and then you try and work out, well, Why does the United States, why do they hate Nicaragua so much? Why do they want regime change in Nicaragua? They want regime change in Nicaragua precisely because Nicaragua represents a mortal threat to the neoliberal corporate capitalist vision of how countries should operate. Nicaragua isn't susceptible to the levels of pillage and looting that you see in countries like Argentina or Peru, for example. And that's why the United States wants regime change in Nicaragua. And there are a whole series of other reasons. I mean, we can talk about the canal and the Interoceanic Canal and stuff like that. But I mean, that is the fundamental reason. And so the socioeconomic model that the Sandinista government under Daniel Ortega has developed over the last 10 years is the reason why the United States wants regime change in Nicaragua. Now, who are their local allies? Who are the allies that these leftists in North America and in Western Europe who criticize the Ortega government and align themselves with the protesters, who are the elements of that opposition to the government here? Well, first you've got Piero Cohen, the wealthiest person in Nicaragua, seventh wealthiest person in all of Central America, according to Forbes magazine. He's promoting the protests. So all those leftists in North America and Western Europe need to ask themselves, do we really want to be an ally of people like Piero Cohen? No, and then you've got Carlos Pellas, who's also an extremely wealthy individual with big sugar interests. I mean, he's kind of essentially held a pistol to the Nicaraguan government's head, because in the previous administration of the neoliberal administration, he extracted a concession, a tax concession, or a tariff concession from the Nicaraguan government administration at the time, enabling his business to sell sugar in Nicaragua at more than the market price. And so far, that was one of the reasons why the conflict began in the first place, because there's a tax reform on the table. One of the issues was going to be, well, will Carlos Pellas still get his sugar subsidy? Let those North American liberals and Western European liberals think about that.
That's right.
So then the other thing, there's so many things. I mean, you've got the business sector there.
We have to stop here, and we'll
so much to say.
Yeah, we'll pick it up, and maybe we can go into this again tomorrow or later on in the week, because there is a lot to cover. And Tony, thank you very much. We appreciate your time as always.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To the summit, can Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un start a meaningful peace process? As well as what's Italy's democratic process means for the EU, and much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Crosstalking the summit, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in London, we cross to Alexander McCurris. He is a writer on legal affairs as well as editor-in-chief of theduran.com. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to London first. Let me go to Alex. Let's do a quick update on what's going on the Korean Peninsula. This time last week, Trump had said no. Now he says yes. What I think is in play is really the inter-Korean dynamic here. This is where the real peace process, if there is one, going to be one, it originated there, and it's going to continue there, and we're going to have to see where the U.S. stands. But even if the U.S. does change its mind once more, it doesn't mean a peace process is over. Go ahead, Alex, in London.
I think that is absolutely right, and I think you are correct to point out that this actually started as an inter-Korean dialogue. The Koreans first started to talk to each other properly back in January when Kim Jong-un basically made a speech, a New Year address. He said, let's go to the Olympic Games, and we've seen this thing take off. Now, I also think you're absolutely right to say that it is the United States which is being pulled along. There are some people in the United States who I think are not happy with this process. But ultimately, what can the U.S. do if North Korea agrees to disarm to get rid of its nuclear weapons, and South Korea says the U.S. troops must go? Does the U.S. say no to those two things? Well, I think some people would like it to. But it might not be easy.
You know, what I think is really interesting, let me go to Dima here. I mean, you know, in looking at the mainstream media, it is the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, not North Korea only. Yes. Also, the North Korean leadership has made it clear, very wisely from a diplomatic point of view, is that they're not demanding a complete immediate withdrawal of American troops. That would be part of some kind of process here. I mean, they are displaying a step-by-step process. Donald Trump, through his last utterances about it, seems to be picking up on that. He said there won't be a deal made in one meeting. Smart, okay, because there won't be one. Uh-huh. On top of it, we have an international charm offensive going on. You usually don't say North Korea and charm, but now we are meeting with President Putin. So this is having a ripple effect.
Well, I mean, it's very easy to out-charm the United States because
these days.
Michael Pence said that developments in North Korea could go along the Libyan model. You know, we all remember what happened to Libya and what's going on there now. So it's not a very appealing perspective. But the way Trump handles it, on the 13th of June, you know, one day after the presumed summit, South Korea has local elections and they have midterm elections to their parliament. So it's very important for President Moon Jae-in, who did a lot for peace on the peninsula, to come to this election with some kind of a result.
Well, there's already results. This is all about a process. Mark, there's still a lot of landmines I want to say there's nothing wrong with being cautiously optimistic, but we do see the past, okay? Lack of goodwill on all sides, including the United States, the last time this happened.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being cautiously optimistic, but I'm not at all cautiously. I'm not optimistic, cautiously or not. I mean, the landmines are so huge. I mean, just the fact that the two Koreas are speaking to each other is already a progress that I think we should recognize, and we should lower our expectations for this, right? But I mean, we have figures in the administration. We have Bolton, we have Pompeo, we have Pence and others, right? We have the U.S. deep state. We have Japan, which does not want to see the two Koreas unified as it has historical animosities with Cuba. We have the South Korean deep state because they have a conservative military and intelligence apparatus, which is not very happy with their own president, right? And some of the gestures he's making towards. Can't remember that just a few weeks ago, when the U.S. pushed defense drills with North Korea that was going to involve strategic assets, including B-52 and F-20 bombers and F-22 fighters, both nuclear capable, that already almost sunk these talks. So it would take only a very small military provocation, and it's not like we haven't seen
those that before. Exactly.
Right, to not only sink this, but to send us in the other direction.
Let me go back to London to Alex here. But one of the things that is, okay, I'll take Mark's, you know, he's not cautiously optimistic, and I think that balances us all out on this program here. But, you know, bringing the Russians on board, the Chinese on board, certainly elements of the South Korean political leadership, I agree with Mark, there's going to be the deep state that's going to be very hesitant. But this is creating a momentum. And anyone that's involved in negotiations, and particularly Donald Trump with the art of the deal, no one wants to have the perception out there that they didn't follow through. And I think this is part of the dynamic that is being played out right now. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, talking about momentum, I mean, let's talk about this off-on summit. I mean, the deep state, people like Bolton, deliberately tried to sabotage the Kim-Trump summit. That was why they were bringing up this business about Libya. That was why all those drills happened. And yet, in spite of all of that, in spite of Trump saying the summit is called off, the summit is back on. And the reason it is back on is because the Koreans the two Koreas responded by talking to each other. And that is the momentum. But Mark is absolutely right. There are all sorts of people who don't like this. Japan might want to go along with this eventually, but it is not going to be happy to have an 80 million population Korea economic giant, a rival on its doorstep. And if one has been to Korea, South Korea, which I have, there is no love lost between Koreans and Japanese.
Oh, none. But I think I'm going to change gears here. But at the end of the day, it's all about country's sovereignty. South Korea maybe want to claw some of it back, and Japan will have to think about its dependence on the United States if a deal is made. All right, let's change gears here. Dima, I was watching the Italian elections with great fascination. Essentially, the powers that be were putting a brake on democracy, the two parties that won more than 50% of the vote, and then they backtracked here. And now we have the EU first lecturing the many figures in the EU lecturing the Italians about how they should vote. But the democratic process is inching ever so slowly forward in Italy. What kind of message is that sending Brussels and the rest of the membership of the EU?
Well, I think the message is don't trust the mainstream media who calls anyone who disagrees with the European Commission populists, far-right, dangerous, marginalized politicians. The Five Star, and the Northern League, they have won together. You know, if we add their percentage of the vote, they won more than 50% of the vote of the people who actually came to the polls. They had the full right to suggest their prime minister. When the president, Sergio Mattarella, tried to sabotage it, that was a scandal. But obviously, there are some changes taking place in the EU, because I think 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the European Commission would simply, you know, push their idea through, because the Northern League and the Five Star committed a mortal sin. They called for an end to anti-Russia sanctions in their so-called government contract. But now, when the head of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, or Juncker in French, when he is saying, I'm quoting this, I do think we have to reconnect with Russia, not forgetting what our differences are, but the Russia bashing has to be brought to an end. End of quote. When such things you hear from the head of the European Commission, something has to change inside the European Union, too.
Mark, I think maybe, you know, again, cautiously optimistic, is that there may be the awareness. It's not the rise of the populist left. It's not the rise of the populist left and right. But it's really the failure of the center, of these centrist parties. And are they going to get on board and understand that people are going to vote for alternatives?
So I don't think you understand the danger that this populist democracy presents to the European Union finances.
I feel like you're lecturing us all now, Mark.
We don't have to lecture, because thankfully the Italian figurehead president rightly recognized that the euro is greater than democracy, right? And acted to defend it by preventing this this joint far-right, far-left government's finance minister, who was very critical of the euro, from being appointed. The EU's budget chief, I think, said it best, Gunther Oettinger. He says it is unacceptable for Italians to vote for populists. The markets will teach them how to vote.
Okay, Alexander, react to that, because I think that was really the best quote of them all. But you know, it gets down to either you promote and work through the process of democracy, or you don't. And in this case, we had glaring polar examples of one or the other. Go ahead.
Why have these two parties, the Five Star Movement and the Northern League, now become the dominant parties in Italy? They've become the dominant parties in Italy because the mainstream parties in Italy, the Democratic Party, the former Communist Party, by the way, some people might be interested to know, became essentially transmission belts for the orders they were getting from Frankfurt and Berlin and Brussels. They were no longer responding to Italian electorates. They were responding to what they were being told to do from the EU centre. Now, given that this has failed in Italy, we've had 20 years of economic recession and stagnation there. Yeah. We have 35% unemployment amongst young people. We have had lower living standards. It is understandable.
Okay. Alex, I'm going to jump in here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Dima, I want to go back to the Italy-EU story here. I want to, on the tail end of what Alexander Mikiris had to say in London, all of this is going on with a looming trade war with the United States. So add that into the mix.
There is a big split in the EU on economic matters, particularly on the so-called Nord Stream, you know, the gas from Russia going to Europe. And it's exactly the same kind of split that we have on the attitude of the EU to Trump's pullout from the Iran deal. Poland and some other East European states, they're for the Iranian pullout. They want to protect Trump from criticism from the EU, and they're against the Nord Stream project. And what is very interesting is the cynical attitude of the United States. I mean, the spokeswoman for the State Department, Sandra Oldkick, denied, I'm quoting, the malicious rumor according to which the US only oppose the pipeline in order to sell gas to Europe. Well, it's not a malicious rumor.
That's partly true.
It's the same kind of a malicious rumor that we heard about Iraq not having weapons of mass destruction before the American invasion, or about the Russian journalist Babchenko being actually resurrected.
Okay, we're going to get to that story. Okay, since you brought it up, Mark, in a nutshell, explain this resurrection of a Russian journalist in Ukraine who's anti-Russian.
Yes.
Okay, I think I got that right. Go ahead.
So this journalist, opposition activist, Arkady Babchenko, he's a veteran of the Chechen War.
On the Russian side.
He tried to get out of military duty by claiming mental illness. In fact, he got caught bribing a doctor to claim he was mentally ill. He ended up not serving when his parents broke into his commander's office and threatened to chain themselves to the radiator. Then he volunteered to go back to the Second Chechen War as a contract soldier. Then he became anti-war. Then he became anti-Russian government. And this is a guy who really has no love for his country, and the country doesn't have much love for him. He celebrated the death of children in a fire in Kerma recently, saying, burn, burn. He celebrated the death of a Red Army choir and journalists that were en route to Syria for a performance, saying they were as guilty as Putin. And he posted on social media that he promised to come back to Russia on the first NATO tank coming into Moscow. So this guy is quite a character.
Okay, Dima, can you bring us up to the present here? I mean this whole scam here. I mean, the reason why I'm interested in this story. I'm not interested in this guy at all. Okay,
he's
a character. I mean, Hollywood stuff here. But
Western
journalists, exactly how they reacted to this. They took it as gospel from the government in Kyiv that the Russians are behind it. There's not any evidence whatsoever that it's the case.
Let me tell you that he is the most famous Russian journalist living now in Ukraine, you know, and he has been before that story happened, because he also covered the Donbas war from the Ukrainian side. He was with the Ukrainian soldiers bombing Donetsk.
He's now employed by ATR, which is funded by the U.S. State Department.
Absolutely. And Russia is such a totalitarian...
Through the American embassy.
Russia, you know, is such a totalitarian country. After bombing Donbas, he returned to Russia, lived here for 3 years, and only left again for Ukraine in 2017, in the end of 2017. So when the news came that his body was found by his wife right next to his apartment after 3 shots, of course, all the officials in Ukraine and in the West, with a notable exception of President Poroshenko himself, started saying that they're sure it was Russia. Let me just quote the Ukrainian prime minister here. The Russian totalitarian machine didn't forgive Babchenko his honesty and his high principles. He was a true friend of Ukraine, which told the world truth about the Russian aggression. Well, if it's the same kind of truth that Babchenko spread about his death, then you can imagine what kind of truth the Ukrainian
media is spreading. Well, that's the point. Let me go back to London to Alexander. The story for me, the only importance of this story is the fact that shows that Western media will take anything, hook, line, and sinker, from the folks in Kyiv that will paint Russia in a very negative light. And we do have the World Cup opening up in Russia very shortly. This is just another way to tarnish Russia's reputation. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, indeed. And if you actually look at the British, the media reaction when Babchenko turned up alive, there is a huge sense of betrayal and anger with Ukraine.
Surprise, surprise, surprise!
They're very angry because of the gift.
They damage this narrative. They expose this narrative as, in this case, a falsehood. And an awful lot of people are very upset and angry with Ukraine for doing that. That is one of the most remarkable things. People are saying, well, the terrible thing about this story is it's going to mean that Putin and the Kremlin propaganda machine are going to be able to exploit this to prove that other things...
I am certainly not exploiting anything. I'm just shining a light on this because that is the only antidote to this kind of propaganda here. Mark, go ahead, jump in.
Okay, so... this whole obviously has some good planning here. The Ukrainian MP who was in on this said that it was done in the style of Sherlock Holmes, because Sherlock Holmes also did something like this, and it was very successful for him. I hate to tell it to this Rada MP, but Sherlock Holmes isn't a real character. I mean, he's fictional, right?
Criminals do it very often. Criminals
fake their money. So we had a fake killer who actually used to be part of these Ukrainian ultra-nationalist battalions.
A fake victim.
The world's first verified crisis actor, right? Lazarus returning just like the Skripals from the dead. I think they must have shot him with certified Novichok dummy blanks, only 10 times more powerful than VX, which means essentially harmless, right? Supposedly, the guy who hired this killer, they're saying, who has links to Russian intelligence, he says he's actually linked to Ukrainian counterintelligence. There may be a business angle because he is partner.
And somebody's a priest in all this.
In a German-Ukrainian venture to build sniper scopes for the Ukrainian intelligence services, and there's a disagreement over who owned this company. So some people say that it was all part of an elaborate corruption scam.
Don't you love our line of business? It's so entertaining.
It's so Ukrainian sorted.
Well, let me just put in a nutshell the reaction of the Western press to all of this affair. Babchenko is alive, but Putin still killed him. That is their reaction. And our great blogger, Patrick Armstrong from Canada, I think he found the most hilarious headline about this. The Babchenko stunt may end up feeding the Kremlin spin machine. So how Patrick Armstrong actually comments on that, I just love it. Those pesky Russians will use our lies to prove that we actually lie? This is impossible. This is unacceptable. But in fact, if you analyze the story, there is something in common that the Babchenko murder has with Trump-Russia collusion story. Both never happened. But there was a hysteric reaction. And the very well-oiled Cold War propaganda machine started working in the West, and now it just can't stop, you know. With Babchenko, it has to stop abruptly because of his resurrection. With Trump, it has to stop because there are no facts, but they can't stop.
Before we started this program, Dima, I was pointing out that you have newspaper clippings, and those are physical. You can save them. But in this day and age, people just wipe the internet clean. Okay, I want to change topics here. Alex, I want to go to you. An important story, it's not getting a lot of coverage, is that the U.S. wants to move anti-missile defenses, the THAAD system, into Europe, presumably because of the withdrawal of the United States from the Iran deal, that Iran is somehow a threat to Europe. This is very provocative behavior on the part of the U.S., considering Europe is staying with the deal with the Iranians. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, it is provocative, but it isn't surprising. And I think the point to make about anti-ballistic defenses and all the rest is that the United States has been driving these now for at least 20 years and is going to continue doing so and is looking for every opportunity to do so. And the primary country that they're directed against is Russia. That is, to me, irrefutably true.
You know, it's interesting because I don't see the security necessity, Mark, but these systems are very expensive, aren't they? I mean, someone's going to be cashing in on this.
Oh, they're extremely expensive, and I'm sure the Trump administration would try to get the German government to foot the bill, his constant complaints.
So you're going to say to the German government, you can't import your cars to the United States, your Mercedes-Benz, but you have to take
our... Well, he's always lecturing them that they're not spending enough on their NATO spending to counter the Russian threat that is actually far closer to them. So the U.S. wants, they're already putting these missile defense systems in Poland, Romania, Alaska, at sea, in South Korea. Now they want to put them in Germany. There's also talk about a new U.S. military base on the East Germany towards the border with Poland. The Polish government is now begging Trump. Yes. They want to pay Trump $2 billion right. for U.S. military forces to put a base in their country, while people around the world are protesting for the 1,000-plus U.S. foreign military bases to leave their countries.
I lived in Poland
the
for
Polish
10 years.
The Polish want the U.S. to occupy their country.
It is bizarre, their behavior. It's because everyone in Poland has an auntie in Chicago here. Now, let me go to Dima here. He's rapidly running out of time here. But I mean, one of the interesting things is that at the end of the Second World War, NATO was put into place to keep the Americans in, the Germans down, and the Russians out.
Exactly.
It seems that the Trump administration is doing everything possible to rearrange the countries, maybe to keep Germany down, but it's pushing the United States out. And we had Macron visiting St. Petersburg with quite a few overtures towards Vladimir Putin, even calling himself an equal to the Russian president.
Well, the problem is that a lot of anti-Russian resolutions, ideas, they're enshrined in the EU's documents.
Sure.
So it will take a long time for Europe to get rid of this pressure from the United States. But I hope Europe will sooner or later liberate itself, not by the European Union itself, but by some other form, you know, probably individually.
10 seconds, Mark.
Yeah. We have a further stretch. Colombia is asking to join.
I forgot about this.
Right? This is another expansion. While Trump is preaching against NATO and saying that Europe isn't spending enough on NATO defense, Poland wants U.S. military bases, in Germany. Now Colombia wants to join.
This is foreign policy follies. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Moscow and in London. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
Colombia.
Okay, this is the extended version of our program where we have political potpourri. Mark Sloboda, you're up first. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I think first we ought to hear our message on anti-propaganda
Good.
Narratives
Good.
From Richard Stengler at the Council of Foreign Relations, U.S. government funded. Roll it.
You'll be the last question, but I just want to weigh in on that for 1 second. So there's another word for master narratives. It's called history. Basically, every country creates their own narrative story. And you know, my old job at the State Department was what people used to joke as the chief propagandist job. We haven't talked about propaganda. Propaganda, I'm not against propaganda. Every country does it, and they have to do it to their own population. And I don't necessarily think it's that awful. And this,
Bravo. Right. The message I take from that is that one country can do it, but no one else is allowed to do it. No one else is allowed to have their own narratives. No. Only one meta-narrative, and it and they admit it. They admit it. It's an extraordinary statement.
It's from the horse's mouth, Richard Stengler. It used to be the number 4 at the U.S. State Department, and he jokes that he was in charge of State Department propaganda. We're not laughing, Richard. He was then the editor of Time magazine during the Obama years, right from U.S. State Department to running our media, right? That's control of the narratives again. The free fourth estate, supposedly, right? And Now he's lecturing us from the Council on Foreign Relations why we should accept this media. I think this confluence between state intelligence and media, the Fourth Estate, is so dangerous. Max Blumenthal said it best. Having four ex-intelligence agency principals, Comey, Clapper, Hayden, Brennan, on book tours and or dominating anti-Trump commentary is a great way to counter Trump's narrative of a deep state coup.
Yep, exactly.
The deep state is really actually in charge of everything, including the media.
And Alexander, let me go to you. They're very open about it, too. I mean, it's kind of the, you know, exposed deep state. I mean, it's no longer shrouded in darkness.
They're out of the closet.
It's out of the closet. There you go. Out of the closet, and everybody can see just how ugly and perverse it is. Go ahead.
And you're absolutely right. And of course, it calls into question its effectiveness, because if propaganda can be seen as propaganda by many people, and the people who are practicing it brag openly that it is propaganda, then it starts to be challenged and becomes less convincing. We also see the other side of this picture, which is a rather dark one, which is when propaganda becomes so important, then of course you have to start suppressing those people who are telling things which are contrary.
Okay, essentially the message is there's good propaganda and there's bad propaganda. Mark, finish up.
But propaganda against its own citizens. He's got no problem with the U.S. government propagandizing its own citizens. That is what he said.
That's how wars have been started. Every country propagandizes its own population. So populations in different countries have absolutely different ideas about what actually happens between them, right? So, but when he says that they used to jokingly call myself the chief propagandist, well, I mean, the joke, the best joke just happened in Ukraine, because obviously no one except Poroshenko and a few people in the Ukrainian security service knew about this terrible provocation around Arkady Babchenko's so-called murder. And Poroshenko was the only one who didn't comment it on the first day accusing Russia. He waited until Babchenko was resurrected. And then what did he say? I congratulate our Ukrainian security service, which gets more and more effective every day in resisting the Russian aggression. And he keeps telling the same kind of lies to Angela Merkel, to Emmanuel Macron. Don't be confused. He's telling them the same things he's telling their population. The problem is they're willing to believe it, and not only in Europe.
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad. Let me go back to Alexander in London. I'm glad Dima brought this up, because it really shows this is just another glaring example of how the Fourth Estate, the media, are in bed with the powers that be. They're just a conveyor belt, a stenographer of the powers that be. And no wonder people watch this program, okay? Because we are one of the few alternatives out there. Go ahead, Alexander Makiris in London.
That's exactly right, because, of course, if we're talking about the media in the country I know best, which is Britain, on so many topics now, it seems to speak with one voice, especially, if I have to say, on foreign policy. And, of course, it is the voice that you would expect it to say if it was acting in unison with the powers that be in the government and in the Foreign Office. The function of the media in Britain, in a democratic society, this has been at least...
Let me ask you a question, because I think it's very important. I mean, you're in the UK. How did you feel about this whole Tommy Robinson saga? I mean... I'm the last person that will stick up for all of his views, because I find a lot of his views to be quite odious, okay? But the lack of due process and shutting down the media, I find horrifying. It's terrifying. And it's like you live in a country that gave us a modern sense of the rule of law and due process. How did you react to all of this?
Negatively, but more to the point, so did many other people in Britain. It provoked protests and it provoked petitions. And unsurprisingly, actually, because when the media space becomes so controlled that it no longer is a dialogue any longer, it becomes a reflection of the national conversation, then obviously people are going to feel increasingly resentful and angry. So it was not clever what was done.
It was both stupid
and it was wrong.
I don't even understand the rationale for the denotice forbidding. I don't understand the rationale. I don't like Tommy Robinson. I don't have anything positive to say about him. I think he's odious. I think he's repulsive, right? But the denotice forbidding media from reporting on it is unfathomable to me. We're operating on media teams, right? Where the media is, as Alexander said, simply working as transmitters of information. And they are extremely partisan in this. During this Babchenko affair, where they claimed a journalist was murdered and he resurrected like the Skripals, Miriam Elder, a journalist on Russia, and she used to be at Foreign Policy, now she's at BuzzFeed, she spoke about the collective trauma that journalists experience. Now, in Ukraine, there have been
11... Is she talking about our trauma that we have to go through all the time?
There have been 11 journalists and media workers killed in the past 3 years, 4 years, since the West-backed Maidan Putsch seized power. They have all been critical of the new regime that seized power. I don't remember her or any Western journalist expressing collective trauma over the deaths of Andrei Stenin or Oleg Buzina or Andrea Rocelli, the Italian journalist. They didn't even comment when these journalists were killed. Why? Because these journalists were working for the other team.
There were quite a few journalists who were working for the Ukrainian government or the Ukrainian government line who were murdered, like Pavel Sheremet. And Poroshenko, the president, whenever he was asked about their investigations, said he couldn't comment on anything. He let the investigation do it. But let me quote him, he will do everything possible not to leave any parts of this investigation that is not accessible to journalists. Well, he has shown his attitude to journalists during these 20 hours when all the journalists were sure that the investigators were basically questioning Babchenko's wife, that they were indeed looking for the traces of the murderer. But in fact, if we look at the world, there are quite a few mega Babchenkos operating around the world. There was a mega Babchenko operating before the war in Iraq. There was a Babchenko in Robert Mueller's commission. There is a Babchenko hiding Yulia Skripal from the journalist so that she reads statements translated from English instead of coming up at a real press conference. So we have mega Babchenkos around the world, basically.
You like that, Mark? Huh?
We are all Babchenko.
I don't like that happened.
We'll have Babchenko's against us. Yes.
All right, gentlemen, we've run out of time here. I hope you've enjoyed the extended version of our program, and I hope to see you next week. Remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.